Senate Agriculture and Veterans Budget Committee will come to order. Today we'll be picking up Senator Kubley's bill, Senate File 480, Low-Stick Energy Development. And Senator Kubley, when you're ready, we're ready. Senator Kubley, welcome to the committee, and I believe you have a A2 amendment. You'd like to put the bill in order?
We do have the A2 amendment, Mr. Chair, and I would like to move the A2 amendment to Senate File 480 as we're getting started.
Senator Kubley, we don't have a quorum here. So
we don't have a quorum,
maybe you
correct.
Can just...
Well, we can
yeah,
wait with that, Mr. Chair.
I think we have it on here. Go ahead and explain it. When they come in, we'll go from there.
Okay. Well, maybe just to kind of hit some of the highlights. There's a lot of things in this bill, Mr. Chair, and Senator Ingebrigtsen. Since you're the only two here, I guess I can't say members, but
we'll take care of it.
Well, first off, Mr. Chair, I think this letter that you sent to Congressman Peterson with Representative Junkie and Otremba, really does speak to, what we're trying to accomplish with this bill. And I think, that was a good letter that you sent out there, and I appreciate that. And I'd like to say that for the record as well. But I do think that, we'll take a quick walk through the bill, and there's a summary in your packet, too, I'm sure, that will help you with some of the details. There are several different parts to the bill. There's a bioenergy production incentive. There's a cellulosic biofuel development incentive. Then there's a RIM portion that deals specifically with clean energy production. And then there's a smaller section that deals with capital equipment loans. So, I think the bioenergy production portion is the part we'll talk about first. But we're looking to harness, the immediate heat and power market for bioenergy crops to develop a supply chain of raw materials that offset existing fossil fuel use. And once liquid cellulosic biofuel facilities come online, the cellulosic material supply will then be there. That doesn't necessarily predetermine conversion technology, whether it's gasification or some other means. But I think you'll notice that, the bill deals with a couple of tiers in terms of its emphasis on the production of both bioenergy and biofuels. So, there's one tier set for the bioenergy piece that deals with the millions of BTUs that are produced. So, and it's set at 75 cents per million BTUs if you're using cellulosic material from current monocropping systems, and that amount is doubled if you go to cellulosic materials that come from the establishment of a blend, really a poly blend of prairie grasses that have been worked on by Dr. David Tillman and Dr. Jason Hill at the University of Minnesota. So we're attempting to utilize some cellulosic material that's already available in the near term and propose to facilitate early use in existing power markets for perennial materials that can supply the raw material that has a much greater output, according to Tillman and Hill, and the research that they've done at the University of Minnesota. They're currently projecting about 240% more ethanol per acre of the perennial grasses than we get from corn-based ethanol alone. You know, I know that, there's research going on in corn production also that will yield, a product that I'm sure will increase the amount of ethanol you can get out of an acre of corn over the next few years as well. I don't think, though, that it's going to reach a point where it can produce the amount more that has already been documented by Tillman and Hill in their research. And their line of increased production from prairie grasses is still going up. So, we don't know where that will level off. Secondly, it deals with a biofuel component that provides incentives for biofuel productions for facilities that are built in Minnesota and use largely, raw material from farmers that are farming in Minnesota. Although I don't believe that the bill exclusively says that there shall be no participation from contiguous counties that happen to lie across the state line. The cellulosic biofuel piece, again, is a two-tiered thing where, payments would be made at the rate of 15 cents a gallon up to a maximum production level of 15 million gallons per facility. And it's patterned, this is patterned very much after the first ethanol bill, Mr. Chair, and I'm sure you remember the details of that quite well from when that came into being, 15 years ago or so. But, it does seem to me that, again, there's a preference given even in the payment structure here for, producing a raw material for the ethanol plant that that actually gives you greatly increased production. It gives you greatly increased soil erosion control. It gives you greatly increased carbon sequestration. You know, the blend of prairie grasses is carbon negative, as we've seen in this committee once before. It provides more wildlife habitat. There are just a lot of advantages to the prairie grasses. I do think we'll be, corn-based ethanol production will be around for another 20 years or so, I'm sure. But, and I do think that it won't really take any acres of corn out of production, I don't think. I think that, the land that these perennial grasses can grow on are somewhat marginal lands anyway. In fact, they seem to thrive on marginal lands, and it allows the soil to build. So I think there are a lot of advantages, and hopefully the two-tiered system can stay somewhat in place. I know there are groups that aren't sure about that right now, and we need to have some ongoing conversations with them. But we'll certainly allow them to speak and, hear from their group's perspective as well. Then the Reinvest in Minnesota Clean Energy part of the bill establishes new working lands where there are additional rim easements associated with lands that are near these bioenergy conversion projects. And I think, that's another piece that is, attempting to support crop production systems that provide the kinds of public benefits we talked about a little bit earlier and to encourage their operation. To me, I think one of the major pieces of this bill that I think is quite important is the local ownership piece. Like the corn-based ethanol plants, when we started out, this bill calls for 51% farmer ownership and even another 24% from community ownership, from community members that happen to live in the area around a plant. And to me, when you look at the work that Dr. Kildegard has done at the University of Minnesota out at Morris, local ownership really supports rural communities much better than the ownership by a corporate entity that is far removed from the state of Minnesota. So hopefully we can, keep that piece in place. I know that there have been some problems with plants that have sold out to a corporate entity after a period of time. This bill asks that that if you do that within a given time period, that you would pay the state back for any payments that you have received while you did qualify for the producer payment. So I see that that community ownership as being a strong reason to support this bill. I'm not going to say it's perfect. We've certainly had some legislation in the past where we change it as we go along, and I suspect that's going to happen somewhat to this bill. But there's a lot of positive pieces here that I think we need to consider and, move the bill along, and, we can do what we need to as we go through the process. With that, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm willing to have other testifiers come to the table, or can take some questions first, whatever your preference is.
Well, Senator Coob, I like the idea of 51% owned by farmers. That started out way back when we've done the first ethanol plants, and then we had to kind of change that a little bit because we needed to get funds.
Mm-hmm.
That still bothers me, though, when I look at ethanol plants. Fagan and Boron own 52% of them, so they kind of control them.
No.
That's because they needed to get the money. So I compliment you on trying to keep it. It's 51% locally owned. Someday we may have to look and change that somehow. But.
Well, that could be, Mr. Chair. I'm with you on that. I certainly think that there's a huge advantage to rural communities if you can keep them locally owned. When you look at the number of times a dollar turns over in community from a locally owned plant and those that are not, it seems to me the advantages are obvious. It's greater than a 5-to-1 advantage. And I think, Dr. Kildegard considers some things that other studies I've looked at don't consider. So I think he may actually be a bit conservative on that, but 5-to-1 is reason enough for me.
Senator Coobley, I'm going to announce we have a quorum present, so if you want to move for the A2 amendment, then the bill will be in the shape you want it in.
All right. Well, I would move the A2 amendment, Mr. Chair. It's a delete-all amendment, and members should have that in their packet as well. This is the first committee this bill has gone to, so you might want to keep that in your mind, too.
Senator Coobley moves A2 amendment to get his bill, the delete-all A2 amendment, to get his bill in the shape he'd like to have it to process at least the rest of today. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? So adopted. Now, Senator Coobley, do you want to maybe I'll ask the members, if you have any questions now, and we've got quite a few people that are going to testify, you might want to ask later. But
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langstaff.
Mr. Chair, in order to get loan from the Bank of Cooperatives, doesn't it have to be wholly owned by farmers, or is it just that 51%?
I'm not sure about that. I don't know if there's anyone from the department who could answer that or not, I guess. But well,
thank you.
Former Representative Peterson may have some information on that.
Mr. Chairman for the committee, I'm Doug Peterson, President of Minnesota Farmers Union, and to the Senator Langseth. I believe the co-op language was changed a few years ago in the state of Minnesota, but I'm not quite sure on the 51% ownership. It may reflect that you do not need that amount of ownership to get a loan from the co-bank. That's just off the top of my head, Senator. Don't know.
Thank you. Senator Langseth, we can double track on that too if this bill moves along. Any other questions from the committee? If not, I think what we'll do then, Senator Coobley, we'll start down the list, and then members feel free to ask a question of the testifiers.
You want to take them in the order they appear on the agenda, Mr. Chair?
Senator Coobley. That's what I would do.
Well, maybe we could have a couple people come up at a time. If Ms. Jensen and Mr. Arnasty would come, that would be fine. We'll get started.
Wife just came out. Who's looking to test?
Okay. So is he here now?
He's right here.
Oh, all right. Okay. I guess Dr. Lehman would like to testify first. He's one of the folks who's been working at the university with Dr. Tillman and Dr. Hill.
Senator Kubik, that's up to you.
Why don't you have a chair here, Dr. Lehman, and
Thank you.
Can go ahead. State your name for the record and then go ahead.
Yes, I'm Clarence Lehman. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for inviting me here. I am a member of the Department of Ecology at the University of Minnesota, and I'm one of the authors of the recent science paper on carbon-negative biofuels, along with Regents Professor David Tillman and Dr. Jason Hill. And I can today give some broad theoretical introduction to the science that surrounds this general topic. I worked at Cedar Creek Natural History Area while this science was being developed, and then I also have had practical experience on my own lands here in Minnesota for 20 years ago restoring prairie. And there I conduct scientific experiments to see what the right ways to restore prairie are in that area. First, I would say there are two clear reasons for biofuels. The first is energy security. In a Yale survey a few years ago, the public ranked dependence on foreign oil as their number one issue, whether they were Democrat, Republican, or independent. And one-fourth of our oil comes directly from the Middle East. That's about 250 supertankers a year. And biofuels can help reduce that. The second reason could be called climatic security. As we all know, burning fossil fuels from whatever source is adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, and that carbon dioxide is a long-lived greenhouse gas. You've probably seen charts that show what it looks like over the long time. Over the long run, the Earth goes through great natural temperature cycles, and the carbon dioxide rises and falls in concert with temperature over thousands of years. It oscillates above and below a central value by about 50 parts per million, up and down. And that minor 50 parts per million has this enormous effect of causing ice to advance across the surface of the Earth and retreat till it covers 30% of the Earth. Well, so we were at the beginning of the modern era. Let's take 1776 as the beginning of the modern era. At the beginning of the modern era, we were at a maximum, the Earth was at a maximum in carbon dioxide. It was plus 50 parts per million from its average. So during the Industrial Revolution, we started burning fossil fuels, and that much of that went into the air. So by the bicentennial, 1976, we had actually added another 50 parts per million. So we were at the peak of 50 parts per million that the Earth ever had in the last millions of years, and we added another 50 by the time of the bicentennial. Now, since that, in the last 30 years, now it's 2006, we've added another 50 parts per million. So from the 50 that was the maximum the Earth goes through, we added 50 and another 50, so it's like three times above the center of the range. And that's the reason that scientists largely agree that unless we fix this situation, we are in for unprecedented effects on the Earth. And effects on the Earth, but then there will be big effects in Minnesota, too. Our state is special in many ways, but one of the ways it's special is that we have the triple meeting point of the three great ecosystems of North America. Right here in Minnesota is where the prairies from the west and the needle-leaf forests from the far north and the broadleaf trees from the east all meet in one place, and they've met here for thousands of years. But according to my calculations using the U.S. Historical Climate Network weather stations, which record weather for the last century, that triple meeting point of the ecosystems of North America is now on the move and heading north. It's heading north at a few miles a year, and if it continues in this present rate and direction, which we aren't sure it will, but if it continues on that present rate and direction, then in about 70 years, it will leave Minnesota for Canada, and Minnesota pines will be no more. We'll be a prairie state instead. Now, this thing from the weather stations matches up with what other people are noticing, like Lee Freleg is noticing this based on what kind of new trees are starting to come up in the pine forests, and what Margaret Davis gets based on actual climate models. But this loss of pines and change in the weather does not really have to be. if we and the rest of the world act now, Minnesota is in a good position to do our part and to set examples for others to follow. We do know what to do. There are about 16 known technologies, any seven of which will hold carbon levels constant for the next half century. One simple thing is, as we increase fuel mileage, if all our cars increase from an average of 30 miles to a gallon to an average of 60 miles to a gallon, that over the next 50 years, that solves one-seventh of the world's carbon problem. And there are 15 of these things known technologies today that will solve the carbon problem. There is no silver bullet here, but there are these 15 silver buckshot pellets, only seven of which have to hit the target. And of course, aiming at something with buckshot you get a better result than aiming with a single bullet, which might miss the target. Many of the points of what can be done apply to Minnesota, and it's well to develop more than one kind of thing and more than one kind of renewable energy. All kinds of biofuels, from corn to soybeans to wood to prairie biofuels, provide certain basic benefits such as reduced coal use, reduced oil use, local availability, energy money kept in the local economy. Biomass from restored native grasslands can give us some additional benefits. And I made a map that shows where in the U.S. are the best places for productivity of natural grasslands. And Minnesota is one of the prime areas. Iowa's good. Illinois is good. So Minnesota is a prime area for this kind of native grassland biofuel. But beyond the basic benefits, the research at the University of Minnesota has shown that bioenergy may not be quite like traditional agriculture. That among grassland species, diverse multi-species plantings give additional benefits beyond the basic benefits for biofuel. For example, they can grow on degraded farmland that isn't used for crops and isn't usable for crops, and they thrive on that. And during the process of growing there, they restore that land to fertility in perhaps a century. So in perhaps a century, that land is usable again as farmland. They need little or no input, no nitrogen fertilizer at all, no annual herbicides. They produce more biomass than simple mixtures do under these conditions. In the controlled experiments at Cedar Creek, diverse mixtures produced more biomass than any of the individual mixtures. And they produce more consistent yields from year to year. That's called greater stability. They're also better at cleansing groundwater of nutrients like nitrogen. In fact, they're like 10 times better at cleansing the groundwaters of nutrients. And there are other benefits that include better habitat for wildlife due to the diversity of species that wildlife can feed on and hide in, and also benefits for people because a restored native prairie or savanna area is the kind of thing people want to live next to. It's a beautiful area that looks like a park, you see. Anyway, the amount of raw energy in this form appears to be enormous. If we took one-tenth of the original prairie area of Minnesota, about the amount of degraded farmland we now have, about the amount of land in various conservation programs, and convert it to high-diversity, low-input native grasslands, then a simple calculation that you can go through based on the amount of land and the energy per acre comes out to that there's a continuous power here available of about 2 gigawatts, over 2 gigawatts. Now, of course, you can't just take this grass and stuff it in the gas tank and drive off. So it has to be converted. And when converting, there is some loss. And over time, those losses, the efficiencies get better and better. But there is a large potential here. 2 gigawatts is, just for scale, an ordinary nuclear power plant is about 0.5 gigawatt, one component of it. A Hoover Dam is about 1.5 gigawatts. So there's a large potential here to be tapped. And so now or in the future, we could do things like burn it directly in pellet stoves that are now emerging and spreading. We can co-fire it with coal, and or even in pellet stoves, we can get electricity as a byproduct. We could use it to supply the processing heat in the current corn ethanol plants, which use a lot of which dump a lot of carbon into the atmosphere because they use fossil fuels. So if we used prairie biofuel to sub to as the processing thing, we can make those carbon neutral, those ethanol plants. It would take about between a half and three quarters of an acre of prairie for each acre of corn to make that whole thing carbon neutral. It could be co-fired with coal to reduce the coal plant's carbon footprint. And for example, this proposed plant in Big Stone across our border, just across the border, I took a look at what biofuel energy would be available there, and they happen to be near a hot spot of the upper Midwest for biofuel, prairie biofuel production. And so they could get about 80 megawatts of power continuously from their plant, which would supply, in a 50-mile radius, which would supply about 15% or so co-firing. So that's the kind of thing that can be done with coal plants. It can be converted to liquid fuels by various, like by digestive means or combustive means, and some of these things are undergoing intensive engineering work today. Anyway, but it seems that we have a chick and an egg situation, which you all realize, where farmers won't naturally start producing this material until there's a market, and the market won't develop until there's material. So that's where legislation needs to be engineered to help. So the subtlety of that legislation, I'm sure, will be quite beyond me as a scientist, but one who's thought about these biofuel problems from the ecological side for a while, I can attest to the potential here. So I'll just close with this remark by saying this paradoxical statement about biofuels. When you burn 1 ton of coal or diesel fuel, that adds 3 tons of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. 3 tons because the carbon combines with oxygen to increase the mass. When you burn 1 ton of prairie biofuel on a restored prairie, on degraded farmland, that actually, when you burn a ton of that, that actually removes a ton of carbon from the atmosphere. Believe it or not, burning that fuel as a net effect removes carbon from the atmosphere. That's an interesting and globally very important property of these perennial biofuels. Well, anyway, I could try to answer any questions if you want.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Cobley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, before Dr. Lehman leaves, you mentioned that, if we could take 1/10 of the original prairies of Minnesota, we could produce 2 gigawatts of energy from what you could harvest off that number of acres. I guess, can you help us out with, some of us don't know how much native prairie there was in Minnesota. What does that boil down to
right.
in terms
well,
of
right.
acres?
Yes. So the amount of, by the way, the 2 gigawatts is the raw energy, and it has to be converted, and so then there's always losses in converting. For a typical coal plant might waste about 60-70% of the energy. That can be improved over time, so it'll go down to maybe 20% in the future. But right now, so that's the raw potential. But Minnesota estimates vary, but one number would be 20,000 square miles, 30,000 square miles, say 30,000 square miles of prairie in Minnesota at the beginning. Minnesota has 80,000 square miles approximately, so that's something like a third of it. And in acres, I can give you that in acres. So right now, that would be about something in the order of 2 million acres. So 30,000 square miles of prairie in Minnesota, say 10% of that is now degraded. Most of that got converted to farmland in the 18th and 19th century. Say 10% of that is degraded. That's about 3,000 square miles, something in the order of a couple million acres, I get. We have, I think, 2,700 square miles of CRP, or 1.7 million acres of that. So it's a few percent of Minnesota. It's quite a large amount of land, 3,000 square miles. So that's a large amount of land for wildlife that isn't there now, or at least is in less than ideal forms now.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Dr. Lehman, for coming and presenting us with your testimony. I've got a couple of questions for you. One is that in many ways this is remindful to me of the discussions that we had a number of years ago about ethanol, when we were talking about the advantages of producing ethanol by using corn and that the effect it would have on reducing our demand for other kinds of fuels and so forth. And And I guess one question is, I'm not aware that there has been any reduction in the use of fossil fuels as a result of ethanol. My sense is we've used more in the last 15 years than less. And I'm also not aware of any climate effects that have occurred by using ethanol. And so I'm a little concerned about the argument that seems to be very reminiscent of one we heard before. The other part of my question has to do with the economics of the proposal that I think we should be aware of. We also, 15 years ago or whatever it was when we talked about ethanol, we were convinced that it was an economically sustainable way to produce a fuel, and yet even the research that you presented us with a few weeks ago would suggest that that's not so, that it's a very marginal gain in terms of a net gain in energy. And my understanding, and I'm no scientist, but things I have read said that the technologies required to convert a cellulosic material into a fuel base are very complex, and that they, in fact, may not even exist today in a way that is efficient and economically sound. And so I guess as we're contemplating this bill, what is it that is compelling to say that this is how we should do this? I know you said farmers aren't going to produce the material if there's not a market, and the market isn't going to exist if they don't have the product to supply it, and that's why the legislation is needed. But that's not typically how the economy works. Legislation doesn't spur the economy. Usually people have a good idea, and they say, here's something that works, and here's how it works, and here's why you can make money doing it, and then they start it, and that creates the market. Why shouldn't we wait for that to occur and instead? And maybe you can respond to some of the questions I'm asking.
Yeah, so the last one, why shouldn't we wait? Now, so for example, there are things that could be done right now with coal-fired power plants to capture the carbon that goes out of their stacks and put it in put it back in the ground where it came from. So that's called carbon capture and storage. But any plant that will do that will have higher price electricity. So even though that is good and, in fact, necessary in the long run, necessary that we do this in the long run, it doesn't happen naturally in the economy, and so it needs some help along the way. As far as the first statement about we did this with ethanol and it didn't decrease our fuel use. Well, it did slightly decrease our fuel use, just not noticeably. In other words, we have ethanol out there, and that is giving about a 25% return on investment at least. Some say more, some say less. But for every unit of energy we put into ethanol, we get 1.25 units back. So, in other words, if you give me a dollar, I'll give you a dollar and a quarter back, you would do it. But it wouldn't make a big difference in your income because it's only one part. And so there is no, as I say, no silver bullet on this. This just becomes one piece. If prairie biofuels were spread all across the world, as eventually I would like them to be, then this would be 1/7 of the world's problem. 1/7. Now, that means we only need 6 more. So there is no single thing we can do, but every piece of this has to be added in. As to what can be done with the cellulosic ethanol, there are things that you can do with it right now that are very easy. For example, it has developed over the course of the centuries, prairie biofuel has, to be combustible. So it's the ideal combustible biofuel. When you burn a prairie and you're burning in non-native grasses, you get a smoldering fire. But when it hits the native grasses, it leaps and it goes. It's really combustible. So it's now ideal to be pelletized and burned burned for either heat or for making electricity. So it's good for that. Other things like converting it, digesting it into ethanol, those are things that are still in development. But another thing, as I mentioned, that could be done is it could be used to supplement the ethanol plant's energy heat use for the distillation. And that then greatly improves the return on investment of ethanol. It makes ethanol essentially carbon neutral. So I think these are all incremental processes. We have to get by 2050, and by the end of this century, by 2050, we want to. The world really has to get to carbon stability. Otherwise, there seems to be no way out of this carbon increase mess. And by the end of the 21st century, I believe we have to get down to zero carbon emissions, and that means we'd be totally on things like biofuels, solar, wind, hydrothermal, et cetera. And so that's a whole century away. Now, if we can do things to hold it carbon steady for 50 years while we invent new methods to bring it back down to zero, then we'll be out of this. But each one of these things is just a part. Ethanol is a part, and it can be improved with prairie additions. This will be a part. Other things like carbon capture and storage, that will have to be a part, reducing the consumption of gasoline by cars. In other words, better gas mileage. That has to be a part. And there will be undoubtedly more than 15 things that go into it. So this is one part that we can do in Minnesota very well and that we can set examples for our neighboring states to follow.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Dr. Lehman. I listened with interest about your negative carbon on the prairie grasses, and it's real interesting, and agree with a lot of what you're saying. But just with regard to the carbon indexing or formula, all plants use carbon dioxide to grow. Is there any difference between native prairie grasses carbon sinking and just a monoculture of switchgrass, or also just soybean plants, for example?
Yeah. Well, first of all, this carbon storage in the soil doesn't accrue for annual plants, because in annual plants every year they're replanted, and so the roots every year die. So it is not accruing there. In fact, this carbon comes out of the soil when you take a prairie and break it up. Now, so does it occur for monocultures of plants versus polycultures? It either doesn't occur at all or doesn't occur as much. It certainly doesn't occur as much. Part of the reason is this. Well, by the way, at Cedar Creek, there was essentially no carbon storage over 10 years in the monocultures, including switchgrass, but there was substantial carbon storage, something like 2 tons per hectare, 2 tons per acre. I forgot these numbers. 2 tons per acre.
More than an acre.
Right. But 2 tons per acre, I think, is the number.
Just ballpark.
But anyway, there is a substantial storage in carbon into the soils on the polycultures. And so why this happens is, in a polyculture, you have different rooting depths. For example, some components root in the upper 4 inches of soil, others in the lower 4 inches. If you just have just that, then any nutrients that go through the upper part of the soil and make it to here have a clear path to the groundwater and aren't used by plants anymore, so they can't use those nutrients. If you have another kind of plant down here that has deeper roots, then it captures nutrients from that level, and it stores nutrients in that level. So the more different kinds of species you add together, the more coverage of this ecological so-called niche space you get. You get different rooting depths that complement one another. You get different times of growing in the year, early season versus mid-season. And all of them overlap then to make more opportunity to capture nutrients, more opportunity to capture carbon, and more to then store it in the roots and then the soil. So the carbon storage in the polycultures was that's where it occurred, in the polycultures and not in the monocultures at Cedar Creek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just so I understand, the carbon is in the roots of the plants as well as in the plant. And if the root is left in the soil, why is that not remaining in the soil?
So in a perennial plantation, a plantation of perennial grasses that live 30 or 100 years, many of the prairie plants can live 100 or more years. In that kind of a system, it's the plant, the whole ecosystem, the whole plant community is really living underground. And when we crop the plants in the fall, it's like giving it a haircut. It's still living underground. So when you cut it, the roots are still alive. They really are the place that the live plant is in the roots. Now, for an annual plant, then it lives 1 year. And so you cut the plant and use the above ground, but the below ground then dies at the end of the year. So the below ground then rots, and the carbon goes back into the air. So the perennial plants, the roots don't rot.
So the carbon turns into a carbon gas?
It's actually turned into cellulose in the roots, cellulose and compounds like that, and also lost in various forms into the soil, forms of carbon that then... So it is in cellulose, lignin, and other forms of carbon that are hard to degrade, hard for bacteria to degrade. So then they remain there for centuries. This carbon storage builds up in the soil over the course of a century or two and then saturates. So we get this benefit on carbon negative biofuels from prairies will be a century or two century long phenomenon. And some ecologists have argued that doesn't matter then because it's only a century or two. It's not forever. But what I say is we really need that century now. We need to buy that century so that we can hold carbon negative neutral now. And during this century, then we'll figure out what to do for the 22nd century.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not going to belabor this, but I don't understand why the carbon that the plant used to grow the soybean, the root portion of it that stays in the ground, doesn't sequester the carbon that it used.
Well, because it dies and rots, and when it rots, it goes back into the atmosphere. It decomposes.
How does it get into the atmosphere out of the ground?
It's a gas, right? Yes. So when the roots of a soybean die, or any annual plant, any plant, then bacteria break them down and break down the cellulose and all the compounds they can easily break down, and they make it into carbon dioxide gas, and off it goes. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Workins, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Scoy, I'm going to borrow you my daughter. She's a plant scientist. I ask her those questions. Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
Clarence Lehman.
Lehman, you talked about needing 2 million acres to reach the objective that you'd like to see us reach. Wouldn't a substantial part of that have to be in one area in order to accomplish an economy of scale? I'm trying to picture, way out ahead of where we are, but trying to picture where something of a great enough acreage could take place to actually create that economy.
Yeah. Well, so if to burn it in a large center, to use it in a large central facility, then economies of scale apply. So that in the paper we calculated a 50-mile radius for collecting biofuel. So that mean?
Somebody's BlackBerry.
So I looked at Minnesota in 50-mile radius sections to see what kind of biofuel is available there. And in, for example, up in the central part of Minnesota, you can get something like 500,000 tons a year in a 50-mile radius. So that's enough for a small-sized power plant or coal firing in a large power plant. In northern Minnesota, there are also hot spots like this. In fact, throughout the whole old-time prairie region of Minnesota, there are regions where you can, in a 50-mile radius, get some fraction of a million tons per year. Then that's for large-scale use. But then there are other small-scale uses. For example, the idea of using this in small-scale pellet stoves, as some companies in Minnesota are now selling, and actually those companies are growing as rapidly as computer companies grew in the 70s. So there are small-scale uses that can be done with it, as well as the large-scale uses. And there are places where you can get a fairly large supply on just degraded farmland that's not now used for direct production of anything.
Senator Workins.
Mr. Chair, that was one of the questions I had, is whether it would have to replace current crops, but you're saying no?
No. All the things I've talked about now, the calculations are just on farmland that's not in production now. And now one can also then say, what if some portion of the corn land were used, as we do for ethanol, and what if some portion of the other agricultural land is used as this becomes profitable? And that would happen, of course. Then quite a bit more land becomes available.
Mr. Chair, one last question. When you were talking about burning the pellets in like a pellet stove, that has to create some emissions different than... What's created then?
Yeah, well, it does create carbon dioxide, but what happens with this kind of a biofuel, like a prairie biofuel, is when you burn it in a stove like that, the carbon dioxide goes out the chimney, but that carbon dioxide was pulled into the fuel that very spring, so there's no net loss, no net addition to the atmosphere. But then in addition, not that above ground part was only part of the plant, because for the first century or two, that plant is still growing underground. It's investing a lot of energy underground. So part of the carbon it pulled out went above ground. That we return to the atmosphere. Part went below ground. That stays there, so that gets sequestered. So that's why I say when you burn a ton of this prairie biofuel, you actually remove a ton from the atmosphere, not by burning it, but by the whole process, because a ton went underground and some tons went above ground, and that got recycled. Now, if you could someday capture that carbon that's going out the exhaust pipe and put it back into the crust of the earth, and there are proposals for that. Now you actually have a marvelous mechanism for pulling carbon out of the atmosphere, and that would be a good thing for the second part of the century should we need to do that.
Senator Dale.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I want to try to provide an answer for Senator Schooley on the question of how the carbon dioxide gets out of the soil and into the atmosphere. And I want to ask Dr. Lehman if I'm right on this. And that is that the organic producer, in order to control weeds and get his crop in and out and so forth, has to do a lot of tillage. And every time he goes across that field stirring in the soil, whether he's cultivating corn or disking, plowing, field cultivating, whatever it might be, disturbing that soil, he's releasing carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. Now, Senator Scoia was talking about the soybean plant, and it grows and it dies, and how does as the roots decompose, how does that carbon dioxide get out of the soil and into the atmosphere? Well, I can see that some probably does get out just through the gases and so forth, but when you till it for the next potato crop or corn crop or whatever it's going to be, that's when a lot of it is released. And I know a lot of organic farmers think that everything they do out there is just wonderful for the environment, but from my point of view, all the tillage that many of them have to do is not good, because every time they go across the soil, they're releasing carbon dioxide into the soil. And you compare that to a no-till system, which I'm on, where there's very little tillage, but we're depending on herbicides to control weeds. I think I'm doing a better job of keeping carbon dioxide in the soil than the organic producer is. So I'd like to ask Dr. Lehman what he thinks about that.
I think that's right. This paper that talks about the 15 different things we can do, this is a paper by Stephen Pakala and Sokolow from Princeton in 2004. They identify no-till agriculture as one of their one thing that could solve one-seventh of the problem. If no-till agriculture were done worldwide, they say that is one-seventh of the world's carbon problem right there. So that's one of these so-called wedges that would help solve it. So even though I don't have direct experience with that, that's what I believe to be the case.
Well, Senator Kubley, we need to move along, so if you want to bring up a couple more of your witnesses?
Thank you, Dr. Lehman.
Thank you.
Then if we could have the we'll go back to the first two people on the list, then, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to corn stocks and planting soybeans.
Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
My name is Diane Jensen, and I'm with the Minnesota Project. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for having me here today. The Minnesota Project is dedicated to rural economic development that benefits rural communities and the environment. Our work centers on renewable energy and conservation, the promotion of local foods in Minnesota, and farm policy and practice that is profitable and also protects the environment. And Minnesota Project is a member of the Clean Energy Minnesota groups. The largest reason that I'm here today, and perhaps that you're here today listening to this bill at this time, is national security, economic security, and environmental security. And that's all driven by oil and global warming, as we have heard. And the good news is that agriculture is the answer to that. Broadly, we know we need to address fundamental energy problems, our dependence on foreign oil. We can't drill our way out of the problems. The cost of oil imports exceeded the value of U.S. agricultural production in 2006. We also know that Minnesota has no petroleum or fossil energy resources. So to continue to use those resources always means we send dollars out of the state. We, of course, are here for global warming as well. Oil accounts for 40% of the CO2 and energy used in the U.S. economy, and we need to do something about that oil. And as mentioned earlier, we need at least two strategies. Sounds like seven might be the magic number here, but at least two strategies. We need much more efficient vehicles and biofuels to replace oil. Neither strategy gets us there alone. So we are going to be looking at multiple strategies as we go forward. Again, on biofuels, agriculture has a major role in solving these problems for America, and the Midwest will play the largest role in that. Corn ethanol is the foundation. But we need much more than that, and we need biofuels, we need cellulose to go forward and meet the goals that are being set forward. President Bush set a target of 35 billion gallons. To get there and beyond, we need cellulose. Minnesota and its productive farmlands are key in supplying the volumes required. We, of course, see this as a huge opportunity for rural development, the likes of which we have not seen in a very, very long time. The 25 by 25 economic model shows Minnesota ethanol production potentially reaching 4.5 billion gallons with cellulosic technology. And energy is a market that exceeds any other ag market. It has been said it is insatiable. We also see that energy crops present an enormous opportunity to drive significant conservation gains on working lands, benefiting water quality, mitigating flooding issues, and creating wildlife habitat by creating opportunities for perennial crops on productive lands at a large scale. This bill is a strategic integrated policy framework aimed at moving us forward. Minnesota's public policies need to realize and capture this renewable opportunity. This builds on national momentum for cellulosic ethanol and creates the foundation for Minnesota farmers and entrepreneurs to engage and profit in this emerging industry. We know there are barriers to farmers to plant new crops and to industry to adopt new technology. On the biomass supply side, we can modify a proven mechanism, conservation easements, to take away much of the risk and challenge associated with new cropping systems. We can also tune the payment structure to reward plantings that provide the greatest public benefit, but still have the flexibility to ensure that the products being produced are consistent with what the market requires. On the biomass demand side, we know that full-blown cellulosic ethanol plants are just at the cusp of commercialization and are waiting for national demonstration projects to come online. We want to be prepared to ensure that Minnesota participates in the development of this new industry. But we also need to understand that there is a need to be mindful that the large-scale approach being taken by USDOE may be a risky strategy. We saw the difficulty of trying to bring closed-loop biomass power plants online in Minnesota. We need intermediate strategies that grow biomass supply chain. Vinod Khosla, the Silicon Valley venture capitalist that is betting so heavily on cellulosic ethanol, notes that the energy transition to biofuels will require a number of intermediate steps, all of which have to be profitable. Using biomass to power existing corn ethanol plants and other ag processing facilities represents a key intermediate step available now. The high price of natural gas allows biomass to compete now if we can remove key barriers and risks for these plants. Minnesota can lead the nation with low-carbon ethanol in the near term. Our bill supports that. We have the room for working with agriculture and plants, starting with where we are right now. We must work through the existing industry to get to where we want to go. Our bill prioritizes and incents native perennial energy crops, but also has the ability to take in existing biomass resources, be it crop residue or ag processing residue. Ultimately, we think of it as building a ladder that helps Minnesota and Minnesota farmers reach a very high level of performance that will be needed in the future in terms of laying abundant and stable sources of renewable fuels. But the ladder that we are trying to build today also includes those first lower rungs that will allow us to start from where we are. This is a stepped-in system laid out in this bill that will allow us to work today with what we have today and move forward to what is needed tomorrow. Thank you very much for allowing me to make my remarks, and I'll stand for questions, or perhaps you want to hear the other testifier.
Let's hear from the other witness, and then I'll ask this.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Don Arnosti, and I work for the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. I'm here today as well representing the members of Clean Energy Minnesota. If somebody would like to distribute this to the committee, the 13 member organizations and hundreds of thousands of Minnesota citizens who are members of these organizations appreciate your consideration of our ideas of how to move Minnesota into the 21st century with regard to clean, renewable fuel. One of the points that I would like to make, and I will keep my remarks very brief because you do have a long witness list, and I know you would like to ask questions and have discussion among yourselves. One of the remarks I'd like to make is the fact that we have tried very hard to reach out to a diversity of interests. We've worked closely with a number of farm organizations and farmers, ethanol producers, traditional ag folks, and others in the development of this bill to date. And I believe, as Senator Kubley mentioned, we think that we have the framework here for a very sound policy for Minnesota to move forward, but we are not claiming everything is perfect and the work is done. And your job as senators and as a deliberative body is certainly to integrate our thoughts along with other testimony and other ideas, and we expect that that process will occur. What I would like to say is that members of Clean Energy Minnesota and those that have helped to bring the bill forward to this point stand ready to work with all those interests to work out a sound policy for Minnesota that works for farmers, works for sportsmen, works for all Minnesotans who are interested in clean water, wildlife habitat, renewable energy, and sound rural communities. We believe this bill does that.
Yeah.
I would be very happy to answer any questions or talk about some of the details of what's in it, but Senator Kubley has already introduced the bill, and I won't do so right now.
Any questions? Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe this question for Ms. Jensen. In your testimony, you mentioned that there were barriers to having this occur. And could you talk about what are the barriers that are preventing the development of this source of energy?
Senator and Mr. Chair, this is, again, a kind of a stepped process. The feedstocks are not out there yet. We are hoping to create additional feedstocks. We also know that some of the science is not quite there. The enzymatic side of things related to the grasses are in development, but it has not reached commercialization quite yet, which is why this particular bill is working at what is available now that would be uses for the biomass immediately, and we anticipate moving forward very quickly with, you know, just about every scientist in the United States working right now to make these cellulosic things work. We anticipate very fast changes as we go forward. But again, this is why we start where we are and move forward very quickly, because we need these pilot projects that we're seeing on a national level, and also we need to make the policy incent further movement to get by those barriers. Another answer would be, you know, certainly we need, as we go forward, we have farmers that are going to have to perhaps potentially make equipment changes as they go forward. And so that's also factored into the bill. There are a number of different aspects, but we've tried our best to work them in. And I may or may not be the best one to answer that question.
And Ms. Chairman, just one question, and maybe if you're not able to, maybe one of the other witnesses can, but would one of the barriers to this be that people can't make money doing this yet? Is that one of the barriers? It just doesn't pay? You talked about investing in equipment, and typically you invest in equipment when you get a return on that investment. But if you can't get the return on the investment, then people aren't really very willing to put a lot of money into stuff. Is that one of the barriers that you thought?
Don, go ahead. Otherwise, I'll pick it up.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, I think maybe instrumental is taking a look at one of our existing ethanol facilities, Central Minnesota mm-hmm. Ethanol, which about 2 years ago, when natural gas prices were very high, took the step, and there's a number of other factors and considerations that went into their decision. They took the step to put in gasification equipment to generate synthetic gas to replace their natural gas usage. They're using a cellulosic feedstock to do that. Natural gas prices have come down. And obviously, are they going to go back up again? Are they going to go up and stay high? Is it an imported fuel? Is it a local fuel? There's a number of considerations that go into it. And at any moment in time, you might take a snapshot and say today their gasification technology might be more than the spot price of natural gas. When they went into it, it's not. What will it be tomorrow? These are all the factors that go into consideration as people think about putting new technology in to utilize a new source. The easiest decision, of course, is to do what everybody else is doing, which is fossil fuel and ride the wave. We know as a nation that has gotten our nation in a place where we don't want to be. You know, we are too dependent on fossil fuels for a variety of reasons, some because of imports, some because of environmental costs, some because of balance of payment issues. And so as a nation, I think there is a understanding that we need to develop a diversification of fuel sources. One source is to take existing technology, which is not commonly in use, but it is available, and gasify cellulosic biomass and use that as a synthetic gas to replace natural gas. This bill will encourage additional ethanol plants, for example, to take that step that Central Minnesota has taken And they did it based on the factors and the information that was available to them at that time. Will they be making money on it? You know, I have spoken with people at that plant, and this was last year when natural gas prices were high, and they were very confident that it was an excellent economic decision. I haven't revisited them today to see if they feel the same way, and we could probably go back in 6 months and ask the question again and maybe get a different read. What we're really talking about doing is helping to introduce new technologies and take people over that bump of unfamiliarity and maybe make that commitment to install a new piece of equipment that they need to gasify biomass.
Kubley, bring your next two up, because I'm watching that clock, and we've got about 7 or 8 people go here yet.
All right. Well, then, just thank you for coming, I guess. If Doug Peterson and Tom Kelleher could come up, you know, I think I could just respond to Senator Hand, too. But, you know, I think there are portions of this bill that are definitely in the future. You know, the research still needs to perfect the production. But there are other portions that are ready to go, you know, the conversion of, you know, feedstocks into, you know, a different form of energy. So, you know, it's a both-and kind of thing, not an either-or.
Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
My name is Tom Kelleher, and thank you, Chairman Vickerman and committee, for allowing me to speak today. I'm a soil and water conservation technician and have been one for the last 28 years in Renville County, Minnesota, the corn capital of the state of Minnesota, so they claim. I manage the conservation easement program in Renville County, and I'm the feedlot inspector for Renville County. So I get on a lot of farms every year, and with the 28 years experience that I have in Renville County, I feel I have a pretty good finger on the heartbeat of what's going on Renville County Farms. We have about 381 reinvested Minnesota conservation easements in Renville County, and that encompasses about 15,000 acres. Renville County is number one in soybeans. Correction, we're number one in corn. We're number two in soybeans. Redwood County is number two, and we're going to go down there and sabotage their bean crop so we can be number one. But we're number one in sweet corn, we're number one in sweet peas, and we're number three in sugar beets. So we're a very intensely agricultural county. The thing that is fairly amazing to me is that we're also the number one in reinvesting Minnesota conservation easements. I think that says a volume towards what farmers think and do. And what they will do if government offers them good choices. And in the past 15 years of the 28 years that I've been a water conservation district employee, both federal and state governments have offered farmers pretty good choices. Our toolbox on an annual basis has grown to help improve the environment and help improve water quality and to help improve water quantity and all of those issues that are associated with it. I'm here to more or less address the conservation easement part of this bill. Of course, I think it's a good bill. We absolutely positively need to get more grasslands on the landscape. The TM Dale situation that we have with water quality in Minnesota is serious. We cannot continue to keep doing the same old, because we're going to keep getting the same old. I think this bill has a marvelous opportunity to allow farmers to participate in the situation that we have with our fuel situation and with our water quality situation. But we have to allow them a mechanism and a way in order to do that. I think if you look back at their past involvement with CRP and the CREP program and the Reinvesting Minnesota program, farmers are up to that task, and farmers are reasonable people. They'll do what's reasonable, and they'll do what makes sense. It's up to government to allow them to have those choices and that opportunity to be able to participate. I look at this as a win-win situation. Not only can we possibly eliminate and alleviate some of the energy situations that we have in this country, but we can also start working towards some of our serious water problems that we have. I attended the TMDL Lake Pepin meeting 2 weeks ago in Arden Hills, and we sat around for about 8 hours talking about the state of our water. And I can guarantee you that we cannot fix this situation unless we get more grasslands, whether it be livestock farming, whether it be reinvest in Minnesota easements for energy purposes, biofuel purposes, but more grassland on the landscape is going to have to be a part of that fix. And the sooner that we start doing that, the better. During the CREP program, Renville County was the number one crop county. We planted over 10,000 acres of native prairie in less than 4 years, rolled it and planted it. So we're pretty good at that. We know how to do that, working with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. The CREP program, which was kind of a hurry-up type program in my mind, it was pulled off with very few problems is because of the fact that we all worked together and farmers they participated to a lot of people surprised more than what anybody thought they would. My closing, I'd like to say that in the 28 years that I've been a conservation manager in Renville County, farmers respond to government. When government behaves properly, so do they. Vice versa. And I truly believe that this bill, if we Soil and Water Conservation District managers have this kind of a bill or this kind of a program in our toolbox, we can go a long way to solving not only our problems, but our water quality problems in this state, too. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman and committee, I'm Doug Peterson. I'm president of the Minnesota Farmers Union and former House member and farmer myself, and I do have CRP acres and in some government programs. I'm only a 300-acre farmer. I just want to comment on Senator Kubley's bill. It seems as it's the best thing since white sliced bread in a church basement. I think it's a pretty good bill. It's a work in progress. I didn't get any out of him at all here. You never do out of Kubley. It's still a work in progress. I'll tell you that Minnesota Farmers Union does support the bill. It supports biofuels and moving toward that. And I've always said that we cannot run fast enough to this technology. I don't think that we're going to get there without putting additional monies into it. I think there has to be additional researches. There must be a commercial biofuels or cellulosic plant put up in this state. There must be commercial growing, because farmers know how to grow it. Do they know how to grow the biofuels, the grasses, and those kinds of things on a commercial basis? There are lots of things that this bill is going to look like at the end of this legislative session. It's going to go through a lot of committees. It probably won't. I can remember when I did the ethanol stuff in the 90s. I think I had to delete everything amendment every day that we had it on the floor in committee. And part of that was to keep the oil people off balance. The other part of it was because it changed. It changed in the countryside, so the stakeholders and the shareholders that are parts of this bill are going to come in with a lot of support. This is about economic opportunity in rural Minnesota, a chance that will never come again. For talking about renewable energy standards, you in this body have already passed that, I believe 61-4 just passed in the House. These things will not come our way again, so if we don't seize the day, so to speak, we will have lost an opportunity for rural Minnesota and for the Midwest in renewable fuels. And as we all know, other part of my life, I'm also an artist. I do lots of different kinds of artwork. And what I always ask myself is, what resources do I have at hand without having to go out and buy something? Well, ladies and gentlemen of the committee and the Senate here, the resources that we have at hand is the grass and the ability to grow things and to use that in a cycle which will be not a carbon-based cycle. And we can't run fast enough to get rid of this carbon situation. That's the truth, ladies and gentlemen. But we support the bill. We think it's great for community ownership. If we don't have that community ownership in piece in there, we'll have just taken the money and moved it some other place, and that's not good for Minnesota. With that, thank you.
Senator Coobley, you have two more.
We do, Mr. Chair. So we'd call on Mr. Falk and Mr. Kramer, and maybe Mr. Batzik could come up at the same time. We have enough chairs here, I believe. So.
Then, Senator Coobley, when we get all done, we can see if there's more questions. I'm just trying to watch the clock and be sure that everybody gets a chance to.
Sure. Appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Falk. It's a pleasure to be here today. I am on the State Policy Platform Committee with Land Stewardship Project and a board member of CURE, Clean Up the River Environment, and am representing those organizations today, along with the fact that they're both members of Clean Energy Minnesota. And I would like to mention that I reside in Senate District 20, and Senator Coobley is my senator, and I'm thankful that he's brought this bill forward. And then I would like to share just a little bit about myself and my business. I operate a grain and livestock farm in Swift County with my wife, Karen, and I'm the fourth generation of our family to work that land and raise a family. Karen and I also own a business, Falk Seed Farm, which is an independent seed company that provides seed to the pretty much to what we consider conventional farmers that are using all the high-tech products and farming the way we typically think of farming. We also source some seed for the organic community. We work with grass seeds, alfalfas, other turf products for lawns, and then we have specialized in the native seed and prairie restoration programs, government CRP programs, and RIM programs out of Minnesota. So because of that experience with these programs, I believe this bill has the ability to provide economic opportunity for our communities while providing environmental benefits for our soil and our water. You've heard a lot of testimony today about details, and I'm actually going to shorten out my testimony a little bit because it would be repetitive. And so if I stumble a little bit, please forgive me, but I'm kind of not going to go over the same thing that some other folks have gone over. First thing I do want to comment on, and you have heard it already, though, is because I came in from Swift County today and drove in here, community and farmer ownership is the key component here, and I encourage you to retain that part of this bill. I think the business model that we have established here protects communities so that we don't have a lot of outside ownership and we lose our control in these plants. Certainly our rural communities have suffered from decline of population as the farm operations gets larger and larger, and we struggle to have the economic development that we need. So we reach out to new opportunities, and this certainly is a new opportunity. The ethanol industry today is a success story, as you've already heard, and community ownership was at the heart of that industry from day one. So I believe that we need to follow that model. The second concept that I'd like to also provide support for is the incentive for perennial crops and using them in this cropping system. You've heard the benefits already, and they're multiple. Sense that we have reduced soil erosion, improved water quality, energy conversion is positive on that. There's energy efficiencies and, of course, the net carbon reduction, wildlife habitat, list goes on and on. And I think there might be some confusion on whether we'll have enough acreage or whether we'll have enough farmers that are going to want to invest in this. And I really truly believe that we have farmers and community support will embrace this new technology and these new plants in the same sense that they're embracing wind. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of community involvement and interest in putting wind projects up. And so the seabed component and wind and the community component in this are really important for our communities. One other comment I'd like to make on the perennial cropping system is that I have a bunch of native prairie right on my own farm, and it borders along the Chippewa River Valley and river, and so we're in a floodplain region, and we're also on some of this blow sand that comes out of that. And I think what we need to consider here is that this program would take some of this land that is sometimes currently farmed. In my case, it is not at this point in time, but I'm pasturing it. But and it would be a tremendous benefit to for the people who are having that are farming that but are having the issues with the soil erosion and having having problems with keeping that soil intact, here is an incentive, and here we'll be taking marginal lands and converting them into working lands. So I think it's a great benefit. So in closing, I ask you to support our rural communities by protecting the business model of farmer and community ownership. I ask you to consider the benefits, the multiple benefits of the perennial cropping system. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Ms. Kramer.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Kramer from Coda Energy. Coda Energy is a combined heat and power plant project. It will be fueled 100% by agriculturally derived material and will be built in Shakopee, Minnesota. Coda Energy is a partnership between Rahr Malting Company. It's a family-owned business in the malting business since 1847. This is our 160th year. And our partners are another family, a little older than ourselves, and that's the Shakopee, Mindawakan Sioux community. Rahr Malting Company facility in Shakopee is the largest malt production facility in the world. It converts over 20 million bushels of barley annually into a malt for the food and beverage industry. To give you an idea of the volume of barley that Rahr Malting processes, if you planted barley on every square foot of Hennepin County, that's roughly how much acreage you would need to make enough barley for us to operate for a year. The malting process requires a tremendous quantity of energy, very energy intensive, both water, electrical, and heat. Rahr Malting currently uses enough natural gas to equal to that needed for 11,000 homes. And we also consume enough electricity to be equal to 7,000 homes. So you can see what energy costs have done to our company. The Coda Energy Project was born out of a desire to stay in business as a malting company in Shakopee, Minnesota. And to do so, we had to come up with a scenario that would control costs and control costs in an environmentally responsible and sustainable manner. We've been in Shakopee, Minnesota since 1936. We're right on the Minnesota River. We live in the community. We understand it. The environment's important. And we'd never do anything that would cause harm to that. So we looked at it and said by using agricultural byproducts from our malting operations, by using other agricultural products located within a 50-mile radius of our plant, we could find enough renewable fuel to operate our project in Shakopee. When it's complete, we'll produce 16.5 megawatts of renewable baseload electricity. This will be enough for 16,000 homes. We'll be operating 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. So if the sun's not shining, we're going to be generating electricity. If the wind's not blowing, we're going to be generating electricity. We'll also provide 100% of Rahr Malting Company's heat and totally eliminate the use of natural gas at our facility and eliminate it using biofuels. To do this, we need 175,000 tons of agricultural material each year, of which 50,000 tons is byproducts from our operating facility right now that we'd need. So we're looking for another roughly 125,000 tons. And our desire is to have a dedicated energy crop like switchgrass. We've actually designed a boiler system that operates very efficiently on switchgrass. So we're a business that in 2008 can use an energy crop, but there's nobody growing it. So, I mean, we're right there and we're ready for it. Our plant is currently in the permitting process at the MPCA, and we intend to begin construction as soon as we receive that permit. And our goal is to be operational late spring of 2008. Obviously, we need a program in place to grow energy crops and to promote the use of agricultural byproducts to produce energy. And this legislation is ideal. It'll enable this to happen. This bill would stimulate the production of energy crops and the technology to distribute the energy crops to users such as ourselves. Coda's location near the Minnesota River would provide an ideal location for this type of project. The incentives in this bill in the form of payments per million BTUs derived from agricultural products used for energy production will ensure that Coda Energy and other bioenergy facilities like ours will be built. Bioenergy is the field of dreams, and this bill will promote the development of a state biofuels infrastructure system. Without this bill, I think the future implementation of new bioenergy technologies such as cellulosic ethanol will be very difficult simply because the infrastructure for the agricultural fuel production and delivery won't be there. And so, you know, we feel strongly that this bill will help develop that, and it's the first step in a biofuels industry. And this bill is critical for Coda Energy. It really is. Coda Energy will be a tremendous economic benefit to Minnesota. We're investing $55 million into this plant in Shakopee, Minnesota. We're going to have an annual payroll of over $750,000 a year. These will be high-paying jobs. We'll also inject $6 million a year into the local agri-economy through the use of the purchases of biofuels. Right now, we buy natural gas. It'll come from Texas or from Alberta. We're using electricity. It'll come from coal in Wyoming. We're going to take $6 million and hand it to people that we look at every day and say, grow crops for us. And I think that's a very strong community-based incentive for a program like this. Also, it's going to protect 100 jobs at our malting company. Our facility is in competition with facilities in Montana and North Dakota that have very cheap energy rates. We need to do something creative to be competitive with them and to stay in business in Shakopee. And like I say, we've been in business since 1847. We're going to be in business for a long time. And finally, this type of a project like Coda Energy is going to spin off and create jobs in the biofuel industry because people are going to have to grow the fuel, people are going to have to deliver it and process it, so it's ideal. And you've heard about all the environmental benefits. Well, you know, the Coda Energy project, you know, I can tell you right now that our generation of 16.5 megawatts will reduce CO2 emissions by 190,000 tons per year versus a coal-fired plant, and we're going to do it without any mercury emissions. Our generation of steam from the biomass will further reduce CO2 emissions by over 70,000 tons a year by us not using natural gas for industrial heating. And I really think that the state needs to be looking at natural gas as a precious commodity for heating homes. They should be looking at ways to promote businesses such as Coda Energy to get away from using natural gas because I think it's going to be more important to use it for heating homes. Finally, the growth of energy crops will improve the Minnesota River by stabilizing soil and reducing runoff into the river. And when I look up in our plant and we go up on top of a tower in Shakopee, Minnesota, it's 270 foot tall. You look down and you see crops, row crops in floodplain where 2-3 years out of every five they flood out. They're in there plowing it. You could grow grasses on something like that, stabilize the soil, cut it once a year. It'd be ideal for us, and it'd be ideal for stabilizing the soil. Finally, you heard about the sequestering of carbon. I think that the crops will do that. And the other thing is wildlife habitat. I mean, there's a lot of hunters and fishermen in our company, and grasses like that would be great habitat. So I'd ask you to support this legislation. Look at the groundwork it's laying for businesses such as ours that are real. And I can tell you, ours is a replicatable system that you could put in any community that needs heat and power. So, I thank you for your time and appreciate if you have any questions, I can answer out. Thank you.
Finally, Mr. Chair, we have Mr. Botzek, who many of you know. He's done a lot of work here for different conservation and hunting groups on habitat, and you know, we'll hear from him now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be very brief. That was a good transition into the hunting and fishing, and I want to talk just a little bit about that. But I represent the Minnesota Conservation Federation, which is 50 sportsmen's clubs. In fact, I just met with Kenyon Sportsmen's Club a week ago Saturday. I was down there, and those guys are talking global warming and climate change and issues that they never talked about before. I mean, they're on the internet, you know, they're on CNN. They, you know, everybody's talking about this. And Audubon Society, Audubon of Minnesota, I represent as well. My first year with them, the commonalities, and you know, those groups tend to not see eye to eye many times, but they see eye to eye on these types of issues. Energy, conservation, and where they really meet up is on habitat, and that's what this bill is all about. And the gentleman just mentioned the floodplain scenario, for instance. But just this past weekend, first, I open up the St. Paul paper, and it's talking about CRP, that the present administration may not sign up any more CRP for the next 2 years. That's a big concern, and we all share that concern about bringing that back into production too quickly and improperly. I pick up the St. Paul, that was the Minneapolis Tribune, excuse me, Doug Smith. I pick up the St. Paul Pioneer Press. This was done by Chris Niskin, talking about warming warning, and talking about the impacts on wildlife in Minnesota. Everything from our trout to our walleye, pheasants, up and down the, everything we hold dearly to the quality of life in Minnesota from a outdoors environmental perspective. This legislation, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, will help in that direction. Will it turn it all around? No. But is it a step in the right direction? Absolutely. It's a work in progress, as Senator Kubley mentioned, and we need to spend the time and effort to make this transition. I like to think about outdoor people, just like the farmers. Whether you hunt or fish, or whether you bird watch, you're kind of like the canary in the mine shaft. You can feel it. You sense it. You know, when you drove past Mille Lacs Lake this year, end of January, and there were no vehicles on Mille Lacs Lake by those fish houses. Now, how often is that? What's happening? There is something going on here. I think we all admit that. The scientists are lined up up and down the alleys and the aisles on that. This legislation, Mr. Chairman, will go many steps in the right direction. We are here to urge your support and urge your action on this type of legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Kramer, I wanted to ask you a couple questions about your project. And I'm a little confused. You're talking about building this project, that you're in the process of doing it, that you have put in place some things to use a different kind of fuel. Why isn't that enough to get people to grow it for you? If you're saying, look, I'm going to buy all this biofuel from the neighboring area, I'll pay this much, why wouldn't that encourage people to grow it? I'm confused about that. If you're saying you're willing to pay for it, that you want to buy it, why wouldn't people produce it for you?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, it's an issue where yes, the agricultural product has value. I mean, if you look at an acre of switchgrass or some sort of grasses, and if you can get 4 ton an acre, there's 60 million BTUs there. At today's rate, that's $400 or $500 worth of fuel in an acre. The problem is we're investing in a technology that costs $55 million, so we can't afford to pay market value. We can't afford to pay $8 or $9 a million BTU, but we can afford to pay a fair price. I think a competitive price in this type of a bill will give more incentives to grow the energy crops.
And Mr. Chairman, and so Mr. Kramer, I take it what you're saying is that right now it's to the benefit of the agriculture producers to grow something else rather than the grasses, and that in your opinion that would only be that'll continue to be the case unless we do something to cause the price to go up, and that's what this bill would do in effect, is bring money from tax sources into this project so that the prices would go up and that it would become economical, but economical in a very peculiar way, I guess. And that's what troubles me about this, is that it seems that the only way we can make these things happen is if we take public money and fund it, and if we don't do that, then the incentives don't exist to make it happen. And I'm troubled by that, because my reading of what we've done with ethanol has been to go down this path for 15-some years, and I'm not sure it's been a net gain. And I'm a little troubled about saying, well, we should do this when, as I understand it, some of the technologies to convert this the fuels into ethanol are still on the drawing board. And there may be other uses for the biomass, as has been pointed out, but it sounds like it's not an economic bargain to do it unless we find some way to bring public money into it to make it happen. And am I reading that correctly?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, certainly any new technology, it needs a jump start. And I think what we're saying is this is a jump start. I do think that it makes economic sense. For this project, it makes economic sense to use biofuels. We could also use, waste wood. We can also use grain dust from elevators. But I think energy crops make sense. It's just that the infrastructure doesn't exist, and you can't. I don't think a farmer will grow it unless he knows there's a market for it. So it's a two-prong approach. I think this bill, starts that process. This isn't going to spur on millions of acres of switchgrass. It's not that big of a bill.
But I think it'll fund projects that will start to make sense, and then they'll say, you know what, we can grow grasses, we can store them, we can process them. When they get ready to build a cellulosic ethanol plant, we've got the technology, we've got the infrastructure built for it. And I think that's what I see. For us, I think agricultural fuels are in the $3 million BTU range. I think that when it's all said and done, that competes quite nicely against natural gas.
Senator Erickson-Robes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, gentlemen, and Senator Kubley for bringing this bill before us today. I think this is very exciting for Minnesota, very exciting for our ag community, and I'm convinced that it's going to be great for the economy, great for our energy needs, and great for environment. And as Al Gore says, that's the triple threat, the triple win. But as I talk to people about this, I do have three questions, and I think one might be for Mr. Bacek, but I'll just put the three questions out there, and then whoever can answer them. I appreciate that. One is, Mr. Bacek, you're talking about the benefits to wildlife habitat. And can you help me understand a little bit more? If we have these fields and we're going to be harvesting them, what sort of habitat are we going to be providing? Because it's just, during the growing cycle. And then is there a plan to coordinate the harvest with bird cycles or... when you talk about benefit to wildlife, what does that mean?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, yes, those are issues that need to be worked out. It's just like harvesting grass from our ditches. This is a big discussion that's been up here many times. When do you harvest grasses now? That's something that would have to be worked out in this equation as well. Obviously, you want to protect nesting areas during nesting seasons, whether it's for pheasants, for grouse, even deer habitat in some of the ditches or the grasslands. And I've also heard, for instance, give you another example where this could be applicable, wildlife management areas. We have a lot of wildlife management areas in Minnesota. We're working hard to get more. Public lands, one of the technologies or strategies they use there to control the grasses there is controlled burns. Well, they're finding more and more opposition or concern with controlled burns because many of our WMAs have been built around have lost that buffering. Again, somebody mentioned that people want to live against some of these natural areas. Well, I've heard a WMA manager say, well, we could harvest some of those grasslands from a WMA and do less burning. So there are some advanced or alternative strategies that we could use on public lands as well. I hate to bring up the public land part into this, but it's not all private land, which is just the opposite of what we usually talk about here. But you're right to raise the concern. The question is accurate. And I don't think all the details are worked out on that, but we need to protect habitat as it relates to nesting areas, but also rotate. So if you're going to grow it, you wouldn't necessarily, just like food strips, you would leave rolls of habitat for food and or cover for animals, especially birds for winter, for instance. So, yeah, these are just management techniques I believe we could work from, and DNR and Bowser and others would, and Department of Ag would work together.
Thank you. Then I have two other questions. One's very quick. I see that giant stalk of something in the back there. I'm wondering if somebody can identify that. Is that
Senator
buffalo
Robes,
grass?
That presenter is going to come up and
okay,
tell his
all right.
Story.
Oh, it's a secret. It's a mystery question. All right, I'll pass on that. Then the last question I have is, is there a plan for how we're going to be able to support producers in the meantime? Because there's going to be a gap between the initial planting of these diverse prairie grasses before they get to be a truly perennial, like, what is it, 3 or 5 years to get established? And then how are we going to fund or finance, these fields or areas where we're going to be planting the diverse prairie grasses until they're harvestable, at a top rate?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Erickson-Robes, from my perspective, that's one of the reasons for offering the producer payment that is included in this bill. It does take a while for a blend of prairie grasses to establish itself. In fact, you know, if you read some of Dr. Tillman and Dr. Hill's work at the university, you discover that they've had their blend of 16 prairie grasses in place for a decade, and I'm not sure that they're convinced that it is fully established. So it does take some time, and it does seem to me that farmers that are going to rely upon a crop like that need some kind of an incentive to start it. And, you know, this is just a start. You know, I think it does jumpstart an industry. We did that with the corn-based ethanol program. I think we can do that again. I don't think, you know, producer payments for the biofuel is going to happen immediately. There are pieces of this bill, I think, that can happen immediately in producing some of their own energy. But, you know, and the RIM acres management piece could certainly get a start as well. But, you know, we may be a ways off, and I'm not sure how far that is. I do think the technology is there to do the production, but we need to have it on a scale that is commercially viable. And so that's another piece of what this bill is attempting to do, is to move it to a commercially viable stage.
Thank you.
Senator Coyne.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just need to respond to to my fellow senator on whether or not investing in ethanol was a wise decision, and I just want to say that I can bring forward facts that I believe the money that the state of Minnesota has invested into ethanol is probably been paid back probably five or six or sevenfold in income tax, in property tax, in sales tax. If you look at building one of these ethanol plants, just the sales tax alone and the materials is tremendous. And so the jobs that we're seeing, I will tell you, I'll give you the example of the plant up in Little Falls in my Senate district. I can remember here not too long ago, the corn was about $1.80 a bushel. Well, you can't even plant it for $1.80 a bushel. And so now it's $3.53, and the farmers are starting to get paid what it's worth. And so what this has done is it's been an investment in our state, and we're the leader in the country. Everybody's looking to us now to be the leader. They all want to jump on the bandwagon. And what we've done is we've invested money, we've got a return on it, and now the farmers are reaping the benefit. Our environment is reaping the benefit, and so it's been a win-win situation. So I just say, go, 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 ethanol.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Coring, thank you for your comments, but didn't you sell your shares?
Unfortunately, Senator, I did.
Senator Murphy.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the idea that we may not, and this is kind of piggybacks on what Senator Coring was talking about. You know, ethanol has been a tremendous success in the state of Minnesota, but, you know, looking at the energy field out there, most forms of energy were developed through some sort of government subsidy, and just the ones that I know are ethanol, solar, wind, nuclear, clean coal, if there's such a thing, hydrogen. You know, at places like Oak Ridge Laboratories and all across the country at different laboratories. And I don't see a reason why we can't do something like this. It makes sense, and it's going to put money in the pockets of a lot of people in greater Minnesota where our job base is continually declining. And, you know, and the people in the metropolitan area get to reap the benefits because, you know, clean water, clean air, go right down the list. And plus, most of the people that come out hunting in my neck of the woods, they come out of the metropolitan area. And, boy, if they come out there and there's not deer to be shot or pheasants or trout to be caught down in Gary's trout stream down there, then we lose that economy, too, because then they decide, well, we're not going to go to Goodhue County or Wabasha County or Winona, you know, so we lose that. So I think that anything that we can do to promote the production of clean energy and do it in an environmentally not only sensitive way, but an environmentally progressive way, we ought to do it. I know the price tags on this is a little bit high, but I know that there's a little bit of money sitting in a renewable development fund, Senator, and, you know, maybe we can legislatively move some of that money around. it seems like every now and again they need a little impetus to spend that money. So you're a big spender.
Senator Murphy, the other day I gave a little speech, and I'm going to pick back up on that. Whenever you subsidize a farmer, it seems like that's an evil thing to do. And we subsidize everything, all kinds of things in this state. So we got to stick up as farmers and say, why can't we get a little subsidy? That's not any. But you know what happened the other day? And I'm going to ask you, probably know that. I went from here back home. My wife says, holy cow, do you know gas jumped 35 cents in just a matter of an hour for some pipe? I think it's 65 cents now since within less than 2 weeks. So it does, and it can still go higher.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to do something to get that down where it belongs. Senator Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Chair, I just have a process question to start with. This bill here is going to the Environment Committee. Which committee is the $30 million going to be carried in? Whose budget, Ag or Environment?
Well, Senator Scoy, all I can tell you is that what we're going to do here today is talk about more policy. The money has to go from someplace else. Am I right?
Well,
maybe you can help.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, I was kind of breaking it down a little bit. The Environment and Natural Resources would carry the funding for Bowser, PCA, and DNR, which for the 08-09 biennium, at least the way the bill stands now, would be about $7.5 million. The U of M would receive an appropriation in this bill right now, and that'd probably have to be worked out about whether that would have to come actually from this committee or not. That's $2 million. The part that would be carried in this committee would probably be about, without the U of M part, would be about 10.3, because we would probably have to carry the debt service and the loan payment, at least for now until it.
And, Mr. Chair, is the 10.3, is that mostly the producer payments?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, the 10.3 is mostly getting some of the debt service and the revolving loan started. The producer payments wouldn't start. The biofuel producer payments wouldn't probably start till about 2013, and the bioenergy producer payments probably wouldn't start till 2011, so that would be out in the tails.
Okay. Real good. Thank you. I'm glad that parts of this are going to be in the Environment Committee, because I really think that's appropriate jurisdiction. Senator Kubley, I also have a bill dealing with cellulosic ethanol and biofuel payments. I think it's a great idea that we have that Minnesota could take advantage of this. I think it's going to be good, as the testifiers have said, for our environment. As I was drafting the bill, I was struggling with the size of the producer payments and, you know, where we should be targeting them. And I see you've got a 15 cents producer payment for production that's, let's see if I can pull the words out of here, cellulosic biofuel produced from corn stover or row crop would get 15 cents, and then they'd have to farm under the United States Department of Agriculture best management practice for crop rotation, pests, tillage that minimizes soil erosion, contain runoff, etc. What kind of acres restrictions is that going to put on our farmers as they're looking to plant crops to deliver for this 15 cents?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, you know, I'm not sure I can answer that specifically. I guess I was thinking you were going to ask a question about the difference, the variation in payments, and it is kind of a two-tier structure. But I think when you look at how much fuel you can gain from an acre of the prairie grasses, to me, that is a reason to provide the incentive. You know, we may need to change some of that a bit, you know, to get it through all of the committee process. I guess, you know, at this point, I'm interested primarily in just, you know, moving it along in the process. We may have to make some changes when it gets to Senator Chaudhry's committee. Or another committee. I mean, there are quite a few of them here. You know, as Mr. Mueller indicated, you know, some comes from environment, some from ag, some from higher ed. There's a variety of places that could be responsible for some of the funding that's needed for this bill. But, you know, if you're looking at a source of raw material for an ethanol plant that produces a minimum of 240% more than we currently get out of corn, even though, you know, corn is going to improve. They're working on the genetics of corn, and that, and you know, the return that we get there will improve over the next 4 or 5 years as well. But I think it's going to keep going up. They haven't reached a point where these prairie grasses level off yet. They could level off at 300%, 400%. We don't know that. But I think the cellulosic materials do offer the best option that we currently know about for becoming independent of other countries for our fuel supply. And so from my perspective, I guess, you know, I don't know if we'll ever get to independence in our lifetime. Well, I don't know how old you are, Senator Scorby. I don't think we'll get there in mine. But, you know, I do think that we need to provide an incentive to develop a base of raw materials for those ethanol plants that gives us that much greater production in addition to providing the other benefits that have already been talked about.
Senator Scorby.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Cooley, I was going to get to the different payments. I wanted to start with that because I'm seeing that, you know, for farmers that are doing kind of normal farming practices now, I'm not exactly sure that these conditions are in line with what, you know, normally a farmer would be doing with regard to his corn production or wherever the stover, corn stover would come from. And then the part that's getting the 30 cents, the twice the payment, is native cellulosic material grown from these standards, et cetera, and as I read about native species, it's a plant that has not undergone a selection process. So I would assume that you're not in support of any plant breeding going on. And I'm kind of curious about that because one of the things that has always appeared to me to be a good benefit to farmers and agriculture in general is that you take a plant and you do selection on it and you come up with a better plant that does a more carbon dioxide sequestration or more cellulosic material from that plant. And why are we discouraging that and making these kind of, well, differentials that are not a positive to agriculture as I would normally think of it?
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair and Senator Scorby, you know, like I say, some of those things may need to change as we go down the pike. You know, I think, you know, I guess as I've tried to think about, you know, why some of these things might be here, it does seem to me that, you know, it's going to be a fairly long process if we're looking at plants that are better at sequestering carbon than the native prairie grasses that have already been identified, just because it takes them so long to build that root mass that you know is the primary area where that carbon is taken out of the atmosphere. So you know, I guess I don't know. I hope that we do look at some of those pieces that you've mentioned and visit about those and see what we can come up with. But I also hope that we move somewhat cautiously before we, you know, before we move in a direction that might not be as positive as it looks because we've made those kinds of strides in monocropping systems. And monocropping systems might be quite different than the polycropping systems that are talked about for this form of production. So I guess I think it's got a ways to go, but I hope that we can continue the dialogue as it moves through the process.
Well, Senator Cooley, I know that part of this could be in northern Minnesota where they got wood mass. I don't think you cut anybody out of here. I think it's just the start of what all we can do. I think I'm reading it right.
Yeah, you may be right there too, Mr. Chair. I'm not saying that what's before you is complete, you know. But you know, we need a place to start, and you know, it seemed like there were quite a few pieces that were taken into consideration. you know, I guess part of my fear was that, you know, I'm bringing you something that is too complex to cover in a single, you know, session for the committee. And, you know, it is going to have more hearings, of course, but they may not be in this committee. So, you know, I didn't want to make it more complex than it already was and have it tabled and not move on because of its complexity and saying, well, we need to take a couple years and study this.
Well,
Mr. Chair and Senator Kubley, you know, this is a delete all amendment that came into the committee. Much of this is the purview of the Agriculture Committee. I mean, certainly the best management practices for cropping would be. I don't know, you know, I don't want to hold you up, but Mr. Chair, is, you know, if this moves along and goes through the process, are we going to have an opportunity to have input into this before it gets onto the floor of the Senate? I look through the bill and there's easements in here that are not less than 20 years. I think that perhaps if there's easements going on to ag land, the Ag Committee should be discussing that. There's a selection of land for bioenergy crop production, water quality, all kinds of conditions there that certainly would be within the realm of the Ag Committee. There's stuff in here talking about spraying of chemicals for noxious weed control. That certainly appears to be an Ag Committee issue. I would think that that this committee would have a fair amount to say about a large number of these provisions.
Yeah.
And we have had some testimony today, but we really haven't had a lot of time to review this. There's appropriation in here for Ag Utilization Resource Institute. That's certainly an Ag Committee.
Well, Ms. Chair and Senator Scoy, you know, I think those things are true, and I think, you know, it's at the chair's discretion, maybe we could bring the bill back after it's been through a couple of other committees and work on some of those issues. I mean, it does seem to me that there are a number of them there that do fall under the purview of this committee. It's the primary reason, you know, now we're asked to suggest a committee that the bill is assigned to, and it seemed to me this one would be the most appropriate for that reason. So, you know, I guess it's up to the committee and, you know, at the discretion of the chair, whether we let it go from here or whether we bring it back.
Senator Kubley, we can kind of move this bill along as it goes through committees, but when it gets to finance, if our committee decides we want to bring it back here, all I got to do is ask for the bill, and it will come back here.
I think that's true, Mr. Chair.
I just want to keep the momentum going.
Sure.
Before we quit here, I have a gentleman from my area that's talking about corn stover and that big tall grass you talked about. So there's a lots of things that need to go into this, but what we want to do is move this bill along. And
Mr.
so, Senator Dill, Senator Scoy,
Mr. Chair, I'm reassured to know that if the Ag Committee has issues with this bill, that we could bring it back into Ag Committee after it's been on its way to finance.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I agree with Senator Scoy completely. I think it's a complex program. It's a lot of money, and it's not easy to totally understand it based on what I've tried to understand today. I'd like to sit down and read it quietly in a quiet room and try to absorb it and hear from other testifiers as well. So I know we have to keep it moving. That's a very good idea. Let's keep it moving, but I think we should just plan on getting it back before the end of the day, before we're done with it.
Senator Dill, I'll assure you that this bill will come back before this Ag Committee after it goes through a few other environmental changes, maybe. I can do that. And we'll just. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I should just clarify. It would come back through the Finance Committee because the same members of the Ag Policy Committee, this came to you as a policy committee, are also members of the Ag Finance Division or the Ag and Veterans Finance Division of the Finance Committee. So when it comes back to the Finance Committee, it could be referred to this as a division of finance, but it would be the same members.
Senator Kubley, if you don't mind, I'd like to have Mr. Forrest. Lauren Forrest, if he would come up and he's got a kind of a different idea, same playing field. So,
You can sit on either.
Mr. Forrest, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Chairman Vickerman and committee members, for the record, my name is Russell Forrest, and this is my father, Lauren Forrest. My father's wanted a no-till farm, his land, for a long time, since 1993, to sequester the carbon in the soil and reduce carbon dioxide emissions that are causing climate change. In 1999, he realized that in order to no-till in Minnesota, the corn stover needs to be harvested from the field. Just for a brief moment, I'll refer you to pages 2 through 4 of the packet that is getting handed out to you. The first picture on the right shows the young corn. The young corn that has had the corn stalks removed from that portion of the field. And on the left is the corn where the corn stalks were left on. The picture on page 3 is simply showing the same thing through a bean field. And on page 4, it's research done at the University of Minnesota Moores that simply reiterates that the carbon loss is through tillage and not necessarily removing corn stover from the field. In order to remove the corn stover, however, there does need to be a market for it. In the last 7 years, my father has found a process that can create a market for the corn stover and is continuing to find people to help build the project that we're working on today. As for me, after graduating from the University of Minnesota, I have spent the last 3.5 years pursuing his and now our joint vision. We're in the process of proposing a new bill to possibly replace Senate floor 480 that will put Minnesota on the path to energy independence. We'll demonstrate to you today the feedstock that we believe to be the most economically, environmentally friendly and help accomplish energy independence. The bill that we are planning to propose will give a larger bang for the buck and will require less state dollars than Senate floor 480 to implement. We request that you look at it with an open mind. The new bill will complement what the federal government is doing instead of competing with them, as Senate Floor 480 does. If you'll turn to your packet on page 5, we have our November report for Xcel Energy and the Renewable Development Fund Program. And you'll notice highlighted that Native Prairie is yielding 2.47 tons per the acre. The switchgrass varieties, Dakota is yielding 3.04 tons per acre, and Sunburst is yielding 7.18 tons per acre. Field corn is actually yielding 14.04 tons per acre, and Miscanthus, which is the large crop that we have a sample of here, is yielding 15.68 tons per acre. On page 8.
Mr. Forrest, maybe you could.
Oh, yep.
Bring that. My vice chair is anxious to see what that big tall grass is.
On page 8, we are talking about the potential of using Miscanthus as an energy crop for Minnesota. And page 9, we simply state that by our figures to solve the energy problem, we'll need 2,800 gallons of fuel per acre to get the job accomplished. Page 10 simply shows some information. We're working with Colin Peterson on a CRP reserve program. We're hoping to get a bill that goes with that. Pages 11 and 12 and 13 pictures of the Miscanthus. Page 11 shows the Miscanthus that's actually growing at the Arboretum here in Chaska. And the red flag marked is about 6 feet tall. Page 12 shows our project back in Laverne, Minnesota, our greenhouse and the 4 plots showing switchgrass, Miscanthus, and field corn where we do our research. And page 13 shows simply the ripe and dry Miscanthus. moving to page, I believe it's 16. The problem that we see is that the 15. The problem we see is that the world is running out of crude oil. Based on the figures I used with world research from 2004, I showed that there are only about 42 years left. My father has friends that have met with the vice president of Shell Oil, and he actually said that 67 years is pretty much the limit. It will happen eventually, but the timing is what we need to know. Our solution to the problem includes electrical generation that can come from multiple sources, including wind and nuclear, diesel fuel that will need to come from biodiesel and coal gasification using the Fischer-Tropsch process, and eventually other fuels coming from biomass. The Fischer-Tropsch process is just named for two scientists that invented the process before World War I, and it was run in German war machine in World War II. Presently, anhydrous ammonia is made using the same process, and Chevron in South Africa has been using the process since the 80s to produce their fuel. We figure that there are about 140 billion gallons of gasoline annually that need to be replaced. Our figures show that corn grain can account for about 15 billion gallons. If we were able to get the CRP reserve program passed, we could use 33 million acres using miscanthus that you see on the table to produce about 62.5 billion gallons. Other 62.5 billions could come from corn stover using this Fischer-Tropsch process. Essentially, on the next page, page 16, there's a comparison of the processes, Fischer-Tropsch and fermentation. It just shows that Fischer-Tropsch uses less BTUs to produce the alcohol, uses less water, uses less energy, it releases less carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, and it has over double the yield per ton of biomass in fuel. Continuing on, I'll try and make it brief based on time. We think that the bill that we hope to propose can actually be more beneficial to starting up plants and facilities and actually reduce the amount of input that the state has to put in dollars. For now, I think I'll actually hand it over to my father, Lorne Forrest.
Actually, we just, Chairman Vickerman and committee members, for the record, my name is Lorne Forrest. Basically, we need to cut this a little bit short, but I would like you to go through this here proposal and read it, but in my world, economics are everything. I kind of got a chuckle out of listening to the guy from Shakopee, Paul. Russell quickly calculated that they were going to pay $30 a ton for the biomass. In my world, the farmer won't deliver it for that. It's not economical, and we'll go ahead and proceed to show you what the break-even costs are on that. Your competition here for the land is the CRP CREP 2 program, and I'm using Rock County's numbers where I live, and this we're going to use the lowest numbers there are. For the range of payments, Rock County's are from 111 to 171 for 15 years on a CRP payment. Then there's a one-time payment of 863 to 1266 per acre up front. The lowest numbers are used in the following example. If you needed 20,000 acres like this for the program that's stated in 480, you'd have a $2.2 million per year expense, and then you'd have another $17 million up front to compete with that. This is a total payment of $19 million. Does the state want to get into this kind of business, and does it synchronize with the free enterprise system? I talked to the president of the corn growers last night. He says, what do we want? More competition for our land. It could be something that farmers dislike. So can the native prairie or Macantus compete with corn stover? First, we figure out the land cost for doing this. The competition is the CREP 2 program. The CRP payment is $111 times 15 years, equals $1,670 per acre. The easement runs for 45 years, so that's $1,600 divided by 45 equals $37 per acre per year. There's an upfront $863 cost. You need an interest charge on that. We're using 8%. That comes up to $69 per acre. So, yeah, and then you got to pay off the $863 over the 45 years, comes up with another $19. So, thus, your land costs come to $125 an acre. So, now we'll take the income off of the native prairie that we harvested. And we're using the 2.5 tons, we come up with $175 income. And now we're coming up with a $225 expense, leaves us with a net loss of $50 an acre. The biomass cost break even here is $90. And we've used all these numbers that we're using here. We've actually talked to farmers that have been in the hay business and transported hay to come up with realistic numbers. The nutrient loss, we've actually taken the biomass and sent it into the lab, and basically you get about a $10 ton nutrient loss by taking and removing the biomass. So now we go to Miscanthus. We're talking a conservative 10 tons per acre. We had 15 tons in our plot. University of Illinois is doing extensive work on this Macanthus, and they come up with over 30 tons per acre at that southern location. But we can't quite ever get that up here in this northern climate, so we're going to use 10 tons as a conservative number, and basically we go through the land charge and everything. We come up with a net loss of $45 per acre, but our biomass cost now is lowered down to $74. This is one of the reasons we want to grow Macanthus. We think this is 10 years out, and it isn't something that we do today. But the corn stover, it needs no land charge because it's charged to the grain production. We take 2.5 tons per acre at $70 per ton equals $175, and then we put our expenses on there of $79, and we actually come up with a $96 profit for the farmer. And basically, the break-even cost on the stover is $31. And the guy from Shakopee, Paul, if Russell's calculations were right quickly, he was going to pay $30 a ton. That's a break-even cost. I doubt he's going to get his biomass delivered to his plant for that figure. So the $70 a ton is what we've been using to entice the farmers to sign contracts. Today, we have 29,000 acres contracted. There's another 12,000 acres that we have yet to contact to contract. I think they will come with that. For everything that I do, I like a double backup. We need 20,000 acres, so we really want to get to 40,000 acres. The bottom line is that the corn stover is the cheapest feedstock to use because it's a waste product and at present needs a market. This allows the farmer to not place a land charge on the stover. As far as the perennial mix goes, to provide nitrogen source, my father always planted alfalfa with brome grass and orchard grass. But by the time the 4 years went by, the grass had consumed the stand of alfalfa, taking away the nitrogen source. Remember, corn nor soybeans are native to the prairie. Then we go to page 28. This is basically a rough idea of what we're trying to work with Doug Magnus and hopefully Jim Vickerman to sponsor this bill. It is... And anything that you do here, you look at the yield. And if the yield isn't there, it's not going to solve the problem. And as we look at all these different technologies, if they don't produce hydrogen, you're not going to get there. It's a water shift reaction that takes place, and you get the hydrogen out of the water, and actually the carbon monoxide and the carbon come from the biomass. Those are the three things that we need to make our... biofuels. So you can read this whole thing later. What we really want is a counter-cyclical payment. That's Doug Magnus's idea. That is something that the state doesn't have to pay. It just guarantees that the project will get its interest payments paid and its principal payments paid, so it doesn't necessarily have to go broke because of low biofuel prices. So we could spend a lot of time on this. Time is short. So what we're really asking for here is $10 million per project, one project per year. And basically, we're also asking for a 80%, 20%, well, let's see. The federal government is now in the process of giving an 80-20% loan guarantee, and this is our application to the federal government for that loan application. Anybody that wants to read it can read it, but I'm not going to make copies specifically unless they do. This is the application from the federal government to do that thing, and what we want is the state to guarantee the other 20%. Now my banker will borrow me the money because he doesn't have a risk in a new venture. So that's kind of what we're looking at there. We want to go back here to probably page 38. We are proposing to build a methanol plant. Methanol is the easiest molecules to attract together, and I will get into that a little bit in the picture thing we have here in a little bit. But basically, methanol price today at Redwood Falls, which is used in biodiesel production, is $2 a gallon. The federal government subsidizes it with 60 cents a gallon. That's $2.60. And actually, we will get a better yield making methanol because it requires less hydrogens and less carbons than ethanol. The reason we are starting with methanol is because most all of the technology is in the world to access, and we'll show you a little few pictures of what we're accessing. Keep it simple. That's probably where we're going to end. But also on page 40, a letter of intent. Every bio provider that we have been talking to and signing a letter of intent to put money into the project as a feedstock provider, we're going to offer them the first opportunity to do this. That's also provided for in the bill back there that we're trying to work on. And then we go to, we were going to have a PowerPoint presentation, but that's not here. So the problem is it is printed out in this little book here. I will hold this up to you. But before I start, I got to say thank you to Max Norris from AURI. We would not be here today without him. What he has done, and he was a hard nut to crack, I'm telling you, okay? But what he has done is he helped finance us to send the Stover to Mississippi to get tested. We need to know what the carbon monoxide level is. We need to know what the cubic feet of gas coming off is. We need to know what the hydrogen level is coming off. We also needed to know how fine it needed to be ground to run through the reformers. And that those numbers have all been calculated. That's what the engineering will be based on.
Mr. Forrest, we need to wind up here pretty quick because I'm losing my members. So.
Okay. This is just some of the pictures of how we're harvesting the stalks. We did that. This is a grinder that comes out of Germany that we'll be using to grind the stuff. We sent stuff to North Carolina to get ground. Here's a dryer that we're bringing in from New Zealand. We have a test dryer coming in about 3 or 4 weeks. It actually dries the stuff with superheated steam and uses has no emissions going to the atmosphere, thus eliminating the thermal oxidizer that the present ethanol plants need to use. We do not want odors or things coming off of there that would enhance the environment. This is a picture of the reformer that's down at Mankato. It's this here thing right here. That's the only one I know of that's in the state of Minnesota. It's at Senex Harvest States where they process beans. This is a blueprint of the methanol plant. It's not very big. It's actually built on site
manufacture, it's all tore down, shipped to us in 12-foot by 12-foot by 40-foot increments, so it can all be shipped down the road. This is just a couple more pictures. This is an actual one that's being built to take the risk out of the commercialization. Does that. There's a methanol catalyst has been run on the commercial scale already that they use. We also have access to an ethanol catalyst, which had not been run on a commercial scale, but we are working on that with the people from Mississippi. That is kind of concludes it. Thank you, Jim and committee members.
Mr. Forrest, I want you to understand that this is just one bill, and there are several bills. There's for corn stover, that grass, and switchgrass. So we're not going to pick and choose in this committee right now anyway. But I'm glad you got this so everybody can kick it and study it. So we need to make work better down in your area where something wouldn't work in northern Minnesota, because this is still going to be a state project if we get it accomplished. So just wanted to be sure that you understood that. Senator Hayden?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can I ask one question? I know you're trying to get, sure. But thank you for your presentation. It's very interesting, and I think it's an interesting idea. Just a question for you. The methanol, what is the market for methanol? What would you say you want to get into production of methanol? What would...
10% of biodiesel is methanol. They use the methanol to strip the glycerins off. Right. So basically, this wouldn't have been possible 3 or 4 years ago because there was not a methanol market in the Midwest. But presently, there is one now, and it's an emerging market. So we have no problem getting rid of the methanol within 150 miles of this plant, really.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, members. I think I'd like every one of you to keep this and study it, work on it a while. It's past our allotted time. We're pretty close to it. Senator Kubley, I'm waiting for you to make a motion, and I believe that motion should be we recommend that Senate file 480 be recommended to pass, and we will move it to the Environment and Natural Resources first, and then we'll follow it as we go along from there.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Amended,
I think Senate File 480 as amended.
As amended. Recommended to pass and referred to Environment and Natural Resources. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Adopted. And members, we are adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Work on with you.